Coming up now is the Space Show. Welcome to the Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie. On this evening's The Space Show, Planet Earth, how satellites are used to monitor the health of our home planet. Welcome to the continuation of Season 4 of our Planet Earth series, in which we look at how space technology is helping us understand our home planet. This is Episode 54.
Planet Earth is blue.
Gamba grass is an introduced perennial grass that has invaded northern Australia's tropical savannas. This includes large areas of Queensland, the Northern Territory, and small parts of Western Australia. Gamba grass produces more biomass each year than the native savanna grasses. This causes an increased fuel load and fire intensity. Consequently, there is reduced biodiversity, tree cover, and carbon stores. The fire frequency is high across the region, with an average of one fire every 2 years. Unfortunately, gamba grass is fire-resistant, regenerating quickly from established tussocks and resulting in a substantially increased fire risk. Because of this, gamba grass has been recognised as a weed of national significance. Critical to the effective management of this weed is knowledge of its distribution and spread. The problem in mapping where gamba grass has spread is we have limited on-ground access to much of the region. Some limited areas have been mapped by airborne light detecting and ranging, commonly called LIDAR. But air surveys are expensive and take time to zigzag across the continent. So scientists with CSIRO, the Charles Darwin University and the University of Western Australia have turned to a satellite to help out. WorldView 3 is a satellite commercially operated by a private company, Digital Globe. It has more than a dozen colour filters or spectral bands operating in both the visible and near-infrared parts of the electromagnetic spectrum. By concentrating on looking at the sunlight colour reflected by the gamba grass as distinct from the colours from other vegetation, the scientists are able to distinguish the weed. Computer analysis can quickly prepare maps over large areas of countryside. To test their method, the scientists used pictures near Bachelor, which is 100 kilometres south of Darwin. To check, the scientists did a ground survey near Bachelor to compare their satellite maps with what was actually on the ground. The results were fed back into the computer in a form of machine learning so that it could make more reliable detections of gamba grass. The maps now have a resolution of 30 centimetres, and their accuracy is up to 91%, which is sufficient to inform landscape management in northern Australia. The satellite is cost-effective at 24 cents per hectare compared to $1 per hectare for airborne surveys.
Earth below us, drifting, falling, floating, weightless.
Now, Harshbir Sangha is the Director of Growth at the United Kingdom Space Agency. In May of last year, he spoke to the Earth Symposium of the European Space Agency. And in this talk, he mentioned the UK-Australia Space Bridge. Space Bridge, you say? What's that? Well, Harshbir will explain.
Good afternoon, everyone. Great to be here. I'd like to start off by thanking ESA for the invite today and to be able to share what is our kind of UK vision for Earth observation, which, you know, contrary to what you may have heard, actually remains very, very strong. So as a way of intro, I am Harshbir Sangha. I am Director of Growth at the UK Space Agency. And amongst my portfolio, Earth observation is probably the most critical element. We see this as a real, real opportunity to grow the UK space sector through the Earth observation lens. So with the UK, we've got, for the first time, published a national space strategy, a strategy that pulls together everything that we want to do in terms of space, both from the civil side and also the military side. The strategy has given us not just the vision for the future, but equally the strength it provides and the focus it provides as far as Earth observation goes. If you look through our strategy, which some of you may or may not have, Earth observation is spattered through across the whole of the strategy. And again, that shows obviously in a way Earth observation strands as far as UK is concerned. But along with that, we in the agency, so the strategy got published last September. We in the agency, we also had a new CEO join us, Dr. Paul Bate, who you may have heard from. He's been on the road quite a bit across globe and across the UK and in Europe. And when he joined, the first thing we did was obviously try and set out what is the kind of the value proposition of the agency? What do we offer, both nationally and internationally? And what we decided was three elements that are quite critical to us. First and foremost, quite kind of inward-looking, looking at how we can catalyze more investment into the UK. I think as an agency and, you know, as my role as growth, that's quite critical. So we can begin to grow the industry, not just in terms of its breadth, but also, you know, the investments we bring in, which is quite critical for our ministers as well. But then the other key element for any agency, and I think for us it remains the same, which is how do we deliver space capabilities and missions, i.e. deliver them better? And I'll focus on some of the missions that we are doing as part of Earth observation portfolio. And the third bit, which is equally critical, which is how do we champion space? How do we engage more people to either through the STEM agenda to take up space as their career path, but equally bring in other sectors who are traditionally not engaging with space, but have got huge dependency on space that they don't know of. So those are three things we as an agency are going to focus on as we kind of move forward. But in amongst that, as I said, Earth observation will remain quite a key part. Some of the missions we are currently engaged in, both bilaterally through ESA, and also some of the missions that we as UK has proposed. In general for us, along with Earth observation, the key lens we are seeing it through is climate. How do we tackle and enable better management of climate data so we can begin to tackle some of the, I guess, obviously, you know, the kind of the biggest challenge we're facing, and not just obviously, you know, within the UK, but globally. And this is not an exhaustive list that we are engaged with as far as the some of the missions are concerned. A good friend from the Italian Space Agency mentioned Novasar, which we are actively working with them as a mission. SWAT that we're working with the French Space Agency and also with NASA. So I'll focus on a couple of missions. Microcarb, it's again a mission that we are working with the French Space Agency. It's a mission that will help. It'll be the first European satellite dedicated to monitoring carbon dioxide. And we expect the data will contribute to global efforts to measure how much carbon is being emitted, both by natural processes, but also how much by human activities. And we hope, obviously, this will become quite a key element in helping tackle climate change globally. TRUTES, I kind of referred to before, it's a first UK-led ESA climate mission to provide radiometric measurement of the sun and Earth with unprecedented accuracy that we haven't seen before, or we don't have the capability and the capacity as things stand. It will create a space-based climate observatory that will not just make, that will make measurements itself, but also improve the performance of other EO missions through cross-calibration, and will enable a tenfold improvement in the accuracy of data. And for us, obviously, you know, this is very much a UK flagship mission at ESA. Now, turning the attention to kind of more what we're doing internally or nationally within the UK, we established a Centre for Earth Observation Instrumentation, funded by the UK Space Agency, and it's a technology programme. CEO for the Space Agency oversees research and development grant programme, which with parallel investment from the industry and academia funds new novel EO instrumentation projects to raise the TRL levels. And that allows us to contribute to broader, bigger EO missions, not just obviously, you know, within the UK, but globally, and along with ESA. So we have quite an emphasis on the raising the TRL levels through COI. We also have got a national program, the National Space Innovation Program. It started in 2020, again, to develop the innovative space projects. But equally, with the lens that these are quite high risk, but equally have high potential. So we as an agency are not averse to supporting some of that high risk, high reward innovation. And that will remain quite a key focus for us as we move forward over the next few years. In fact, our new CEO, our new minister, is quite keen that we're trying to enable the high-risk, high-reward innovation as much as we can as an agency. Keeping with the kind of international collaboration, we are a major partner with ESA. We will remain a major partner with ESA, as things are. We're collaborating on SEOS and GEO. And, you know, we have mentioned on the slide, it's a UK-Australia space bridge that you probably would have heard of. It's quite a critical bilateral partnership for us. But then again, obviously, you know, UK-Australia space bridge is not the only critical partnership for us. There are many across the piece. But then we know with the UK and Australia, at least we've got very, very similar intentions when it comes to Earth observation. So we're trying to not just exploit the opportunity, but see where we can better collaborate on some of the action. I'll finish by saying just two or three critical points. The Earth observation remains a key priority for the UK. We, as an agency, as I said, we've set our North Star lens, our value proposition, which is very much focused on missions and capabilities. And I think those missions and capabilities, it'll be a failure on our part as an agency if they don't focus on the kind of broader, bigger challenges that we face, which is tackling climate change. So we'll very much focus on supporting those where we can. And indeed, obviously, you know, we want to work, you know, as collaboratively as possible. And I'll probably just finish by talking about the elephant in the room. You probably hear about Copernicus, many different elements coming out. From our perspective, from the UK perspective, we very much want to be part of Copernicus, the EU programme. So as soon as we get the green light to be participating in the EU programme, we are very much ready. So I think that's the message I'll leave this audience with. But equally, thank you for having me here. And we're very much ready to work as collaboratively as we've done in the past. Thank you.
That was Harshbir Sangha, the Director of Growth at the United Kingdom's Space Agency.
This is Planet Earth. You're looking at Planet Earth. Bop, 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 bop. This is Planet Earth. Earth. Earth.
New Zealand's main firefighting and emergency services body is called Fire and Emergency New Zealand. It has been using an automated fire growth and smoke forecasting decision support system to monitor and manage fires. The system uses data from both United States and European satellites to monitor forest and grassland fires. The European Sentinel-2 satellite provides imagery of resolution 10 metres, while the Sentinel-1 gives synthetic aperture radar scans that can penetrate smoke. The satellite database is being used to identify fuel types. Early results suggest that machine learning models can detect a range of fuel classes. Now, here in Australia, machine learning methods are being used to predict bushfire ignition occurrences from lightning forecasts. During 2016 in Western Australia, it was verified that 145 lightning-ignited bushfires were identified. This was about 70% of the cases. And fire-related air pollution has long been a problem in South and Southeast Asia. For example, Singapore, Malaysia, and Indonesia are, at certain times of the year, blanketed in smoke. Satellite-based measurements revealed that in the year 2020, at the height of the shutdowns resulting from the COVID pandemic, fire-related air pollution decreased in the region. South Asian countries had an overall reduction of 0.26 teragrams of particulate matter emissions when compared to previous years. Similarly, Southeast Asian countries in 2020 showed an overall reduction of 1.1 teragrams of particulate matter emissions compared to the non-COVID years. Now, Thomas Pesquet is a European Space Agency astronaut, and here he is answering some questions about climate research that is being done from the International Space Station.
So there's hundreds of experiments on the space station in all kinds of different domains, but some of them study specifically climate change. There's one on the outside of the space station that's called ASIM. Is built in Denmark, and it's an experiment that looks at the phenomenon that are occurring in the upper atmosphere when there's a thunderstorm. We know there's lightning strikes going down to the ground, but there's also some phenomenon occurring and some interactions occurring in the atmosphere. And this is a phenomenon that's not really well understood, but we think it plays a major role in our general climate. And as thunderstorms are going to be occurring more and more with climate change, we need to understand this phenomenon. And this is one of the examples of a specific experiment dedicated to climate change. But also more generally speaking, with my mission, on my mission patch, I have the Sustainable Development Goals from the UN on my patch. And the goal is to really raise awareness to the importance of acting to reduce poverty, inequality, to improve health and education. And really all the aspects of those Sustainable Development Goals are tackled using a space mission and a manned space mission, a human space mission, as an example. So the aspects of climate change that we can see most directly in space, there's many really. We can see the glaciers melting. We can see the glaciers reducing inside, you know, over the course of several missions, not just in 6 months, but you know, astronaut after astronaut on the space station take pictures. We can see this. We can see air pollution. We can see forest clearings. We can see water pollution. But really also what we see more and more are those violent weather phenomena, the thunderstorms, hurricanes, landslides. All this can be observed from our vantage point, from our crow's nest. And this is getting more and more concerning, so we need to act now. Also, there's plenty of tools on the space station to make measurements regarding Earth observations. There's payloads, scientific payloads on the outside of the space station. This one is called the Orbiting Carbon Observatory, OCO. It's a NASA Earth system, and its sensor uses sunlight reflections through the atmosphere to measure variation in atmospheric carbon dioxide, which is obviously a big factor for climate change. There's also EcoStress, also a NASA Earth Science payload that uses a radiometer to measure plant temperature and how plants use water, which is something we must understand to be able to manage water in the areas when it's scarce. Also, we deploy regularly some miniature satellites. It's called nano satellites. We have a couple airlocks on the space station that we can deploy them from. It's really cool. It's like shooting satellites out of the space station into their own orbit. They're being built sometimes by small companies, by universities, by students, and most of them have a function that has to do with climate change and doing some measures about Earth observation. Finally, I think we're doing Earth observation, the astronauts themselves. So we have a wide array of big lenses, long lenses, And by taking pictures after picture after picture, it's not as good as an observation satellite. But if you put together all those pictures over the course of many years of Earth observation, you have a set of data that you can mine, that you can use to have some conclusions. And finally, you can make some measurements from the space station. We have those small mini computers called AstroPi, and they have a set of sensors. We've set one up not so long ago to take pictures of the Earth. And there's also a payload that NASA calls Earth Cam, and it's controlled by students. And you can actually, from your classroom, take pictures of the Earth. I think that's pretty cool.
European Space Agency astronaut Thomas Pesquet.
You're listening to 88.3 Southern FM, the sounds of the Bayside.
Planet Earth is blue.
One year ago, the Government of Canada awarded funding to three Canadian agencies to develop a new wildfire monitoring system known as Wildfire SAT. The three agencies were the Canadian Space Agency, Natural Resources Canada, and Environment and Climate Change Canada. The mission has a planned 2028 launch and a 5-year mission duration, although this could be extended. The satellites will have sensors detecting visible, near-infrared and mid-infrared light. The three satellites will be able to map actively burning fires to a resolution of 15 by 15 meters. The mission will measure the rate of fire spread as well as carbon emissions and smoke plume dynamics. We have this feature from the Canadian Space Agency. It's a spokesperson from the Canadian Space Agency talking at the Earth Symposium of the European Space Agency in May of last year.
I'm very proud. As you heard, my name is Éric Laliberté, and I'm very proud to be here representing Canada, a special member of ESA since 1979. I'm also very excited to come here and share with you the latest satellite Earth observation strategy that was just issued in January of this year, as well as share a sample of the activities that are under the strategy. I find that we have a common approach. We have a common dedication to making sure that we're not just collecting data, but we are actually able to change it and get it into information. Our strategy is titled Resourceful, Resilient, and Ready, and that represents what we want Earth observation to do for people. Here you have basically the four objectives that we have: ensuring benefits for mankind, that are maximized, harness EO to tackle the climate change. We want to strengthen the delivery of critical services, and I'll give you an example of what I mean when I say critical services. We also want to inspire the next generation so that we have the skills to use EO in the future, and we take on the challenge together of using EO to make the world a better place. Now, I said end-to-end. It's part of that, and therefore the next step, that those are beautiful words, but next step for us is to really capture into an adaptable implementation plan all the activities that we are doing, that we want to propose for investments, in a comprehensive illustration so that decision makers have the big picture. It's also about developing this adaptable plan. And the key here is to be able to present to decision makers what the overall, what are these investments. Now, as we know, governments have priorities, governments change, but the beauty with an adaptable plan is that you can switch things around a little bit, but still have the big picture. You want to finance one before the other, and that is the key behind this whole of government, because it brought together it's now 20 different departments. For the first time, there's a collective vision that is presented and was supported by our government. Here is the Earth Observation Service Continuity Initiative that we have. We are building the architecture that will follow the RADARSAT constellation mission. So what comes after that? We use radar in Canada for obvious reasons. It's a big country, a lot of places uninhabited, and also weather is a factor. So when we are looking at the future, we're looking at structuring this architecture, taking into account, well, the changing environment. We have free and open data that we need to account for. There is the international collaboration that is basically giving us or exchanging capabilities with Canada. So we want to take that into account. There's what we call the sovereign system, which is still a government owned and operated portion of the architecture. But make room for this commercial space and commercial services. So let's account for all these pieces as we define the architecture. Another example that falls under the new strategy, and I'm proud to say we just barely a month ago, we got the green light to build a constellation of 3 satellites to monitor wildfires. You would know from all the news the impact of wildfires in different countries. In Canada last year, it was really terrible. So we are moving forward with this new constellation. It will have an operating mission of 5 years, and basically will fill the gap that we see in the type of observation that is being done in the help of wildfire. The idea is also, as I mentioned, end-to-end, it's to get tools right from day one of operation, tools in the hand of the people on the ground actually managing the fires, responding to the consequences, or dealing with the impacts. Now, I told you about critical services that we want to continue. This is based on the RADARSAT constellation mission up to date. We have very intense integration of the services and the data into government services. So there's 70 different programs that are using the radar data that we collect. It's over 12 departments, and the system is collecting 250,000 images a year. So it's a 50-fold increase from the first time that we did RADARSAT 1, so it's a 50-time increase. And we have a process of going through vetted users. We have now more than 160 vetted users. More than half of those are industry and academia. But there's also an international component, and that is also growing. We were able to basically work within the regulations that we have in Canada to be able to share the data as much as we could. With respect to the strategy, you have the 4 objectives that we have here, and examples of activities that we have started. So we did not wait to have the strategy, but the advantage of the strategy is that it brings, like I said, all the government departments together and say, this is where we want to be. So in maximizing access, I talked about regulations. Well, we're in the process of reviewing that to make sure that we're coherent with what is happening in the world. There's also mention of the signature of the Canada-EU Copernicus collaboration arrangement. That was done last week. We're very proud of that. We are entering into different arrangements. There's one between our environment department with UMetSat. And also we're looking at the Digital Earth Canada. So something that every country is realizing, that we need to have the real infrastructure that transforms data into information and has the potential for people to come and play with the data, for innovation, for discovery, all kinds of things. I can go quickly. I mentioned WildfireSat, but there's also other missions that we're working on. There's a terrestrial snowmass concept that we're looking at. Snow in Canada makes sense. So we're interested, but it's not about snow, it's about the water cycle and water management, which is becoming more and more of critical. Then an example in strengthening our critical services. Well, I talked about EOSC as a follow-on to the RADARSAT Constellation mission. Last year, we got additional funding to move forward some key technical development. So that's ongoing, but we're also investing in the renewal of our ground system with Natural Resources Canada. So with this, thank you very much.
Earth below us, drifting, falling, floating, weightless, calling, calling home.
James R. Webb is Professor of Astronomy at the Florida International University. He's been wondering, why has life evolved on Earth over billions of years? The song is called The Grand Scheme of Things.
Where do we stand in the grand scheme of things? Stars are born and die. In the billions of years of history, we've existed just the blink of an eye. A star formed and blew itself apart. Heavy elements littered the sky. The sun formed and the planets too. The laws of physics, they tell us why.
Tell us why. Evolved and they died. Intelligence progressed throughout history. Now we know enough to ask why. Tell us why.
Tell us why.
Tell us why.
We need to know why.
The year 2020 was looking to be a relatively normal year for crops until the COVID-19 pandemic and the associated lockdown policies happened. Reduced air and ground travel caused the demand for ethanol to plummet. This caused corn prices to decline. Lockdown policies also made it harder for government officials to travel to farms and collect information about crop planting, progress and conditions. The subsequent lack of public information about crops caused uncertainty and volatility in agricultural markets and prices as growing seasons progressed. As University of Maryland scientist Hannah Kerner said, and I quote, "Markets want to know how much of a specific kind of crop to expect," end of quote. Now, Kerner and her team has used data from American and European satellites to map where and which crops are growing. Specifically, key commodity crops, that is, corn and soybeans in the United States and winter wheat in Russia.
Planet Earth is blue.
Well, it's 3 decades since the European Space Agency's European Resources Satellite was launched. Some of the engineers involved got together recently to remember the satellite's achievements.
ERS-1 was the first remote sensing satellite for the environment that ESA had flown. There were meteorological satellites before, but ERS-1 was the pioneer measuring all types of different environmental information, but the first in Europe.
ERS-1 was the starting point for everything that in a lot of the observation capabilities that we have in space now that we take for granted.
After ERS-1, we had many other missions. So basically, ERS-1 is the grandfather of all other missions.
In July 1991, the European Space Agency launched a unique Earth observation satellite from Europe's spaceport at Kourou.
And over the days after launch, it's called the launch and early operations phase, the satellite was stabilized, the instruments are switched on, and then they're checked out to see that they're working correctly. The pleasure and the privilege of working with the world scientists on the first C-band SAR imagery and developing all of the applications from scratch. And that's where I had some fun a few months later in the field of SAR interferometry.
You know, my memory of that is just how lucky we were to be able to use those tools, work with those people, and benefit from the expertise.
I remember more or less I didn't sleep for 48 hours in that story, but still, this is probably my best professional experience, and it was very early in my career, so an incredible souvenir for me.
There was information in there on agriculture, on forestry, on oceans, on ocean waves, on ice. You could just select all of these images and put them up, and people, you could see the science community just roaring to go and work on it.
And the rest is history, as they say. Now it's all routine and commonplace, but in those days it was trailblazing and a privilege to be working with those people.
Today, there's been a long discussion about the archive data, preserving the archives. Well, some of the observations, the planet has changed in 30 years. Sea level has gone up, temperatures have gone up, there has been deforestation, there has been urbanization, there has been coastal change, there have been glaciers retreating. That data has contributed to our understanding of all of that, but it's vital. It contains the record of how the planet was. So, I mean, everyone who contributed to that was laying down a historical record whose value today is, you know, enormous.
And you're listening to The Space Show.
88.3 Southern FM.
Earth below us, drifting, falling, floating, weightless, calling, calling home.
The Global Precipitation Measurement Core Observatory is a satellite that has been in orbit for 9.25 years. It has 2 instruments that continue to perform well. They are used to quantify when, where, and how much it rains or snows around the world. Scientists have been refining the algorithms to improve the accuracy of the data collected. This work includes improved intercalibration with the measurements made by other satellites. Another change has been to increase the width of the radar swath and to publicly release these dual frequency observations. NASA is seeing how the satellite data might support operations within the transportation and logistical sectors. Hazardous weather, such as extreme precipitation, fog, and severe storm systems, are known to cause problems for these sectors. For example, poor visibility, icing, and turbulence affect aviation. Flash flooding affects road transport. Identifying data, needs, and priorities to improve weather monitoring and forecasting is of vital importance and could have significant societal benefit. The Global Precipitation Measurement Satellite is jointly operated by NASA and JAXA, the Japan Aerospace Exploration Agency, in association with more than 20 international partners. Earth-observing satellite data is already used by the aviation industry. For example, imagery from the 16th Geostationary Operational Environmental Satellite is used to detect icing threat areas, convective storms, and fog. This satellite, which is also called GOES-16, has a lightning mapper to assess convection and icing probability. Infrared data from the European Meteosat-9 satellite is being used to identify deep tropical convection. One well-known aviation hazard is ingestion of small ice crystals into jet engines. Another hazard is the accumulation of ice on the wings of aeroplanes. To detect these threats, accurate detection and distinction between freezing rain and freezing drizzle is needed. The existing ground-based radars and satellites are not able to detect the difference. The proposed aerosol, clouds, convection, and precipitation satellite will go a long way towards meeting the needs of aviators.
Did you know NASA keeps track of food production from orbit? Pioneering scientists of the 1980s realized that satellites could see plants growing from space. This monumental discovery occurred when NASA scientists figured out how to use satellites to measure chlorophyll in plants, which is reflected as green light into space. With a flood of new data pouring in, NASA, USDA, and the University of Maryland created an online tool that could track crop health anywhere in the world in real time. The team called the inaugural platform GLAM, Global Agricultural Monitoring. The system has withstood the test of time and is still in use today. Inspired by technological advancements and increased computing power in recent years, additional global agricultural monitoring systems have been developed, including NASA Harvest's GLAM-2. Here at home, when a massive derecho hit the Midwest in August of 2020, satellite data helped analysts to rapidly assess the damage. This natural disaster caused upwards of $4 billion in damage, one of the costliest windstorms of the past decade. Using Earth observation data for these types of damage estimates helps American and international markets prepare for potential commodity crop shortages. In the face of more extreme weather due to our changing climate, food security is one of the most important challenges of this century. NASA technology is helping keep our leaders informed, our markets stable, and our populations fed.
Those of us living in Melbourne don't often see what are popularly known as vapour trails from aircraft. People living beneath the Melbourne to Sydney flight path are more familiar with them. More properly called contrails, these distinct white trails of clouds are produced when the water vapour from aircraft engine exhausts condense in the cold stratosphere to liquid water droplets. Whilst the trails over Australia quickly disperse, returning the sky to its natural clear blue, that is not the case in many parts of the Northern Hemisphere. No sooner has one contrail begun to disperse than another aircraft puts up another of these human-made clouds. On some days, North America is covered by a semi-permanent cirrus-like cloud that dims the sunlight reaching the ground. The effect has grown from the 1940s as stratospheric air travel has boomed. When all airliners were grounded for several days after the terrorist hijackings in 2001, the skies cleared of these contrails. Scientists at the Langley Research Center in Ohio have been studying contrails for a couple of decades. They have found that although their effects vary and are difficult to quantify, their overall net effect is warming. In response to COVID-19, travel bans and lockdown policies, people in 2020 were flying a lot less and producing fewer contrails. The Langley scientists have seized on this opportunity to ask the question, are fewer planes and fewer contrails helping to cool the atmosphere? They are using satellites to determine contrail optical properties to better understand how they reflect sunlight and trap energy from the surface and atmosphere below them. The findings won't just be of academic interest, doomed to a forgotten research paper in a scientific journal. The scientists could inform airlines on ideal routes to fly planes. They say, and I quote, "It might be possible to reduce contrails and their effects by making occasional flight altitude or routing adjustments, much like airliners do now to avoid turbulence." End of quote.
Planet Earth is blue.
There's an important series of satellites been operating since 1972, and they're called Landsat. And we have a profile here of the woman who designed the multispectral scanner for these Landsat Earth observation satellites. Her name is Virginia Norwood, and this feature comes from the Goddard Space Flight Center.
In the 1960s, the United States decided to venture forth to the moon's surface. This new vantage point of space allowed us to look back at Earth's surface in wonder. Photographs taken by astronauts on the Apollo and Gemini missions fascinated the world and inspired a few to ask the question, could space be the solution for regular Earth observations? One piece of technology, dating to 1968, has since defined Earth remote sensing from space. It was initially doubted, but the little scanner that could defied all cynics to give us what we know today as the Landsat program. This instrument, called the Multispectral Scanner, or MSS, was designed and championed by Virginia T. Norwood, earning her the moniker, the Mother of Landsat.
The Landsat system is an amazing one. It makes you wonder if the MSS system hadn't been on board and operating, what would have happened to Landsat?
Virginia Norwood graduated from MIT with a degree in mathematical physics. Soon after, she developed a radar reflector that discovered previously untrackable winds. Her continuous successes got her a position at Hughes Aircraft Company. She was amongst the first women to join their technical staff, where she pioneered the first space-based multispectral scanner.
She said I was kind of known as the person who could solve impossible problems. So people would bring things to her, even pieces of other projects.
Norwood was working at Hughes when NASA initiated the Earth Resources Technology Satellite Mission in 1967. As scientists at the University of Michigan and Purdue demonstrated, the future of land imaging was multispectral. They used this developing technology to assess the planet's surface on a more local scale. Multispectral devices like the MSS measure energy from the electromagnetic spectrum, including both visible and infrared light. The sensor acts passively, recording certain wavelengths of light reflected off the Earth's surface. These measurements are recorded digitally and transmitted to ground stations to be analyzed pixel by pixel, something that had never been done before. However, NASA and USGS both had reservations. The MSS was new technology, and they favored the Return Beam Vidicon, the RBV, designed by RCA to map the moon for the Apollo missions. The RBV used television tube technology to create a system of cameras, each filtered to a specific set of wavelengths or bands. They were limited to the blue-green, orange-red, and near-infrared bands. The system was analog, limited, and soon to be dated. So how to convince them to try multispectral technology?
People felt much more comfortable with that, even if they didn't understand the ramifications. And so we felt that there was a real bias because of that.
With the help of other innovators like Jack Lansing and Webb Howe, the prototype designed by Virginia Norwood was created for only $100,000, less than $1 million today. Her original designs included a scanner that looked at 6 bands of the electromagnetic spectrum. However, because the more trusted RBV system was heavier and larger, taking up more of the satellite, she had to cut back to 4 bands.
And really only a tiny corner of the spacecraft was allotted to the tiny little multispectral scanner. And no one knew precisely how it was going to perform, whether it would even work, whether the mirror would work, whether the digitized data would work. From the get-go, her superiors were saying, hand-wringing, that this was going to be a problem. There was so much about it that was novel, and there was so much skepticism.
To allay NASA and USGS jitters about the much-doubted scanner, the prototype was stuck under the back of a truck and taken on a California road trip.
This was because George Olaskas said, "Nobody believes that scanner will work. I think you better give us some assurance." And so Jack Lansing and a couple of people took it out on a truck. And he was an outdoors type anyway, so he just thought it was great to get Tahoe and Yosemite and all those places.
The images were spectacular. The half dome image still hangs on Norwood's wall today. On July 23, 1972, the Earth Resources Technology satellite launched into orbit with Norwood's sensor on board. Just 14 days after launch, a power surge caused by the RBV electronics physically rocked the spacecraft, and the RBV was immediately shut off. The first cloud-free image from the MSS was the Ouachita Mountains in southeastern Oklahoma.
I looked at those images and tears came to my eyes. And I said, "It's everything we hoped for and more than we expected." It was, I could say, the highlight of my career, and one of the major highlights of my life was to see that and to see that it worked and to think about what we could do with it.
Virginia Norwood, incredibly innovative, pulled off something that nobody thought would occur.
Virginia Norwood's MSS became the standard for the Landsat satellites. A 7-band sensor, a refinement of her original 6-band design, flew on Landsats 4 and 5, and went on to shape much of space-based land remote sensing, a field that has only grown since then. 50 years later, using technology that has evolved from Norwood's original concepts, Landsat satellites are still showing us more about the planet we love. In 2021, Landsat 9 launched into orbit. The data, now freely available to everyone, will bring about new scientific advances, helping us to better understand our changing planet.
And this has been an episode of our Planet Earth series.
This is Planet Earth. You're looking at Planet Earth. Ba, 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 ba. This is